The thing about introducing these folks is, of course, they don't need an introduction. And if I did introduce them at the full depth, I'd take the entire time. But I'll still introduce Phil briefly, noting that he was a chancellor at UCSF, director of Institute for Health Policy Studies at UCSF, was an assistant secretary twice, both under Johnson and under Clinton. And one of Phil's joking notes of how he should be introduced would be in part to note that Pete was the smart son, Huey was the handsome one, and Phil was the dumb one. And, well, you sort of say, well, Phil's not that dumb, but the fact that he'd go back to Washington a second time does give a little credence to the fact that there may be a little dim-wittedness somewhere in there. And so with that, Phil.
Peter, thanks for that insulting introduction. Pete has really given a very good overview of the context within which policies were developed at the time of the Millett's Commission when I was in Washington. And but prior to that, in the 1950s, we first had the report of the President's Commission on the Health Needs of the Nation in 1952. That was Truman's alternative to national health insurance. And our father actually served as a member of that commission. And many of the things we did in the 60s were described in that report. There was then the Bain-Jones report, a report to the secretary on physician and other health manpower issues. And then there was the Bain report to the Surgeon General in 1959. So that by the early 1960s, there was a significant body of information pulled together around the needs, particularly issues around physician supply, physician shortage. And the common view was, not only with respect to specialization, but in fact that there was a significant shortage of physicians in the country. And it was within that sort of mindset that we began the policy activities in the 60s. Also in the 1950s, President Eisenhower introduced or proposed legislation in 1956, which included support not only for research facilities, but for the building of medical education facilities. The legislation passed, but without the medical education facilities. Funding was there for research facilities as the money was flowing into the medical schools for the support of research and was in effect transforming the medical schools, at least those that garnered the research dollars in the 1950s. Also, another factor, and Eisenhower did that again in 58, again, they expanded the research funding, research facilities funding, but not funding for medical education facilities. And the other factor in the 50s, started in the 40s, that was to impact on residency training particularly, was the Hill-Burton program, which resulted, of course, in the modernization and the construction of many hospitals, many of them in the suburbs, but not funding of public hospitals because they received tax dollars from either local government or state government. So then we began in the early 60s. Kennedy proposed legislation early on in 1963 when the Millett Commission was established. Congress passed the first Health Professions Educational Assistance Act of the 1960s in 63 in the fall, and over the course of the next 5 years, progressive additions were made to that until 1968, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But also, other things that were not intended, at least as they were being considered, Medicare in particular, the debate on Medicare did not focus on either civil rights or on graduate medical education. But in fact, Medicare was to have a profound impact in both of those areas. After Medicare was passed, very early on, we began to focus on because Medicare policy simply reimbursed hospitals on a cost basis. You incurred the cost, you got reimbursed for those costs. And included in those costs were the costs of interns and residents and the costs of supervising physicians. And the In addition, of course, the higher costs of patients in a teaching hospital were also part of that reimbursement. They were to become explicit in 1983 when the DRGs were added to the process, and we really changed the way hospitals were paid. But in meetings we had, and Bill Longmire at UCLA, who was then chairman of the Council on Medical Education of the AMA, was one of the really instrumental people in advising us on the development of those policies. And there were both the policies that related, that influenced this, the explicit policies on GME, but the policies that were, you might say, unintended but had a major impact, of course, were the payments for physicians' services, Part B of Medicare. And there, because of the usual customary and reasonable payment method, it was whatever you set your fees and what the fees were in the community were basically what was paid. And as the procedure-based specialists were used to charging more and did charge more, and general practitioners in the main were not high chargers, and particularly if they were in rural areas, so you had this very skewed system of payment that over time made things progressively worse. And it wasn't an intended effect of Medicare, but it certainly was an effect of Medicare. And many of the details, I mean, the Social Security Administration, which was then administering the program, spelled out the broad policies and left the details of implementation to the various Blue Cross plans, which were the intermediaries for the hospitals, and mainly Blue Shield, which were the carriers for physician payment. And as a result, you had policies that differed from one part of the country to another in terms of how this was implemented. Medicaid, of course, was quite another matter, and it was dramatic in the early days of Medicare and Medicaid. The resources that were put in by the federal government to the implementation of Medicare, in contrast to Medicaid, which was basically a welfare program administered through the Welfare Administration in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, not through the Public Health Service, not through Social Security. Social Security didn't want to have anything to do with it because it was a stigmatized population. And Frank Land, who was a family physician, actually general practitioner, I think Frank was from Nebraska, was the first administrator of that program. But that was a largely state-determined policies, and as a result did not have the same impact. Now, with Medicare, another unintended consequence occurred in 1966 when it was very clear that the Civil Rights Act had to be applied to Medicare. The courts had decided in 1964 about Hill-Burton, and any hospital that was to receive Hill-Burton funds from that point on had to be desegregated. And the hospitals didn't believe it. Most of the doctors didn't believe it. But in fact, the president was absolutely firm on this issue. It was a value-driven policy. It wasn't a focus group. There weren't polls taken. And as a matter of fact, it was politically very detrimental to the Democratic Party to desegregate the hospitals in every congressional district in the South. But that is, in fact, what happened. Over a very short period of time between February of 1966 and July. And not only did this have a profound effect on those institutions, when we began that process in some states like Mississippi, only about 13% of the hospitals admitted black and white patients. In other states, it was a much higher percentage. But that process moved very, very quickly. But more significant even, perhaps, than the impact on the southern hospitals was the impact on residency programs in northern hospitals and southern hospitals. There were fewer black residents in northern hospitals, lower percentages, than there were in the south. Many southern hospitals that were desegregated had a larger numbers of black residents in contrast to hospitals. Well, that very quickly disappeared after the Civil Rights Act was passed. And I think Lou Sullivan, actually, who later became the secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, was the first minority physician to intern at New York Hospital So we saw a profound impact, totally unintended, by the Civil Rights Act and Medicare. And then by the time I reached UCSF in 1969, Clark Kerr had been president of the university until, as he said, when he was removed from his position when Reagan was governor, he said he left the presidency as he came to the university, fired with enthusiasm. But while he was president, he instituted policies that we would now call affirmative action, and that there was a profound change, first of all, in the admission of minority students. And in 69, we were recruiting black students from actually all over the country. We had recruiters going out to recruit. Within about 3 years, it was not only black students, but women. And the whole place was transformed within a decade, as has happened in most medical schools around the country. Again, the Civil Rights Act, people didn't really think about this impact, but it was to have a profound effect on medical education and then on graduate medical education. Well, in 68, the process of the Health Professions Educational Assistance legislation, that year we had the most comprehensive support for medical education and other health professions, dentistry, pharmacy, veterinary medicine, nursing, and provided not only grants for construction, loans for students, scholarships for students, but support for medical education. And the goal was to both increase enrollment and to increase the quality of education. And there were grants specifically designed to support innovations in medical education. And my deputy at that time for Health Manpower, Ed Rosinski, who was a medical educator, Ed's training was in not in medicine but in education, was the principal person behind that idea that there needs to be, from the federal government, supports for innovations in medical education. It wasn't until 1971 that the federal government took a position on family practice. Actually, in the 60s, we didn't take a position because there wasn't a board, and we didn't want to say that the federal government should dictate to the profession what it should be doing, although a number of general practitioners, Amos Johnson among them, were advocating to us that we do exactly that because they wanted to break down some of the barriers more quickly. But I think that the way it went was really the right way. Well, the family practice residents we supported in 71, and as a result of that, the numbers increased. In 69, there were 30 family practice residencies. By 1975, there were 219. And by 77, all of the public medical schools had departments or divisions of family medicine or family practice. Only 50% of the private schools did that. Now, the federal policies were, in a sense, permissive. There were grants to be provided if you developed those programs. Unlike, say, the Civil Rights Act, which was a regulatory and radical change. In 79, the federal government expanded the funding beyond family medicine to other primary care residencies, particularly general internal medicine and pediatrics. Now, by the 1980s, we were not talking about a shortage. We were now talking about an oversupply. We had doubled the enrollment in medical schools. We had increased the numbers, as Pete said, from 85 to 125, but doubled the output of the medical schools. And we then had a kind of a steady state, and it's been a relatively steady state since then, but with a dramatic reduction in federal direct support for medical education. The research support for research has continued, and the 800-pound gorilla, of course, has been Medicare in terms of funding graduate medical education. Now, unintended consequences also with respect to federal manpower policies from the Justice Department and the Labor Department. Labor Department said in the 60s there's a health manpower shortage, which then resulted in changes in the immigration laws, which resulted in very significant increases in the numbers of foreign medical graduates, now called international medical graduates, in the residency programs. Also, after Medicare, it's interesting that the number of residencies in affiliated hospitals that were medical school affiliated went up from 48% in 1964-65 to 77% by 1970-71. So in a five-year period, a dramatic shift in the affiliation of residency programs with the medical schools. Also, the number of foreign medical graduates, if you can believe, in 1951, there were only 1,350 in residency programs in the United States. That was 9% of the total. By 1969, there were 11,000. It was 32% of all the residents in 69. So that shift occurred, and it's been relatively steady since then, although the numbers go up about 4% a year. It is still the percentages haven't shifted as dramatically as they did in those early Medicare days. So when the hospitals could get the money to pay the residents, they added residencies very, very rapidly. And they continued to do that until this year. I've mentioned the unintended impact that Medicare had both on the GME policies and on the payment policies. If we could have the first slide. Is there some way to flip that on? It's that. Oh, there's some. Oh, here we go. Here we've got it. It's like a miracle. Pete talked about these figures, and this is just a recapitulation to see the dramatic effect, and this is, I think, principally a Medicare effect. If you look at the growth in clinical faculty, we've had almost an eightfold growth in clinical faculty since 1965. The number of medical schools has doubled. Since 85, the number of med students has hardly increased at all, and we see, again, this huge increase in the residents and even greater increase in the clinical faculty. If we could have the next slide. Then you look, Pete mentioned the revenues, and you see the huge impact. Where is the money coming from? It's like Willie Sutton. You know, he robbed banks because that's where the money was. Well, the medical schools added clinical faculty to generate the revenues, which have now been the major factor in support of medical education. If we could have the next slide. We notice here that in 60-61, 36% of the revenues came from research, basically from NIH. Now, the money's increased still, but it's now only 18%, whereas clinical services, and that includes faculty practice plans and hospital and medical school programs of providing medical care, now up to 48%. And if you don't think that doesn't influence the policies of these institutions, where you are dependent then on the support of your educational enterprise from your faculty practice revenues. And, of course, in what some people would consider the good old days, when it was fee-for-service and everything you did was a revenue generator, now those become cost centers for many of these services. We'll see what happens. Now, we find that Medicare, like NIH, has now become the dominant federal policy without being intended. And, of course, the Medicare policy for graduate medical education, until 1997, there was no federal policy except we'll support whatever the hospitals do. And those residency training programs have continued to be dominated by service needs and the interests of either the hospital or a clinical division head. Again, the policy said we'll fund you for whatever you do. We'll not only fund you with direct support for the resident and the supervising physicians, we'll pay you a lot more for every patient you take care of, even though it's been clear for years that the indirect medical education payments were far in excess of what the actual costs were for those patients. And you had incentives in states like New York because it was based on where we were in 1984. They based these payments. Montefiore gets $200,000 per resident. Hospitals in Iowa get about $40,000. Now, if that isn't an incentive, and you wonder, well, why have the residents increased in New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey? Well, it's a very clear, very perverse incentive. Now, with the Balanced Budget Act, for the first time, Congress has said we're not going to fund any more residents. We're going to put a cap on the number of residents. They also have given some incentives to New York to reduce the numbers, and they have now passed that on. They basically hold harmless for a five-year period if you reduce the number of residents. And when we look at each of these areas, we see unintended consequences of the policies on graduate medical education, on medical education. And certainly there's been no incentive in any of the federal policies with respect to, except for these small discretionary grants out of the Bureau of Health Professions, to support the development of family medicine in the medical schools or in residency training programs. And you compare those dollars to the Medicare dollars to GME, which trained huge numbers of physicians in specialties in excess of what the needs were. There's been no focus on geriatrics or the needs of the elderly in funding of the GME programs in Medicare. And now we have a movement with the Balanced Budget Act to support managed care, I mean, to move HCFA from being a payer to being a purchaser. And I think we can anticipate unintended consequences of these policies as well. And nobody is really looking at that. The one thing they did in the Balanced Budget Act, they said, we're going to reduce your IME funding over the next 5 years by about $5.5 billion. But we're going to take the money away from managed care plans, about $4 billion, and give it to the teaching hospitals at 20% per year. So they take it away with one hand, give it back with another. There will be a modest reduction also in the payments for direct medical education in an attempt to really slow down this constant growth. And the only reason that happened this year is because the Republicans control Congress, and Senator Moynihan from New York isn't able to prevent that continued flow of funds uninterrupted without any limit into the teaching hospitals in New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So we've had over the years, over the last now 40 years, and going back to the context of Millis and the problems that they were addressing, as Pete said, we're still facing many of the same issues. The federal policies, Hill-Burton, NIH, certainly had no beneficial effects on primary care, on the development of this, or on the development of family medicine, either as an intellectual field or as a practicing specialty. We have Medicare policies, which have now become the dominant policies. Again, perverse and unintended effects. The only policies that were really directed towards sort of a rational system were the health professions' educational assistance funds. We still have, you know, about $200 million maybe in the Bureau of Health Professions, maybe $250. And Medicare has about $7.5 billion just to support a graduate medical education. NIH is $11 billion, so it gives you some idea of where the incentives have been in the federal government. I think it's been a miracle to my mind that family medicine has developed to the extent that it has in the face of these very, very formidable, not only obstacles within the institutions, within the universities, but because of these financial incentives that have flown from outside into those institutions to accomplish what's been accomplished to date. Am I any more optimistic about the future? I would say I don't think so. I mean, I think we have to look at the unintended consequences of managed care and see if we can anticipate what those will be and try to move to get some more rational policies. And maybe with Peter's help, we can do that. Thank you.
I'm astounded, Phil. That was ever so brief.
Well,
I appreciate this.
You intimidated me.
Not likely. Introducing Dr. Hewlett Lee. Huey's the past president of the Palo Alto Medical Clinic, is the emeritus executive director of the Palo Alto Medical Clinic, a trustee of the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, professor at Stanford University. As my dad noted, he's a surgeon. At one point, he was, however, doing so many hemorrhoids that he was known as a vascular surgeon, though he is a general surgeon by practice. Huey will give a perspective on the Millis Commission's impact on the real world and practice, rather than the lofty ivory tower of the world of the Beltway.
Lawyers are the real ones we want to do hemorrhoidectomies on. it's really an honor here as a specialist to talk to all of you primary care people, and particularly to follow these distinguished members of my own family. As Pete just had a birthday, as he mentioned a couple days ago, and he's now older than Mickey Mouse. And he found on a trip to Italy last year that he was older than most of the monuments. So it's I've had three older brothers that were in med school at the we were all 1 year apart, and I learned from all these guys the easy way to get by everything. They would tell me who the professors who graded easily were, and who the ones didn't require you to work very hard were, and the ones who didn't have 8 o'clock classes and all those things. So I had a much easier time getting through than they did. I could just flow along and learn by their mistakes except toward the each time I'd get introduced to a new professor, he'd say, "Oh my God, not another Lee." Well, that's what all you can say now. Oh my God, not another Lee. I had the pleasure of interning in those days when there was still an internship at Western Reserve, and Wern was the dean, and Millis was the president, and these things were beginning to ferment at that time. And then I came back. I had a residency at Stanford in San Francisco in the old days of when a surgical residency, you know, the final pay of the final year after 6 years was $150 a month, and went to joined the Palo Alto Clinic in 1956. And at that time, we were 70 physicians, and all but three were specialists. We had three general practitioners at that time and 67 specialists. And concerned by the ever-decreasing impact of the general practitioner, my dad and his grandfather said, and he's quoted in the Millis report as saying that we should build a monument to the general practitioner, bury him, and originate the concept of a personal physician. And as you know, there's been some discussion this morning already, what to call this new personal physician that was beginning to evolve as a result of the Millis report, and then the later creation, or the very soon later creation of the Board of family practice was generalist, primary care physician, family provider, and so on. And ultimately, out of the distillate came the term family practitioner. And with meaning had three additional years of training, passed an exam, and this began to occur at the time when there was really severe increasing fragmentation of the care. And I think this is one of the problems with healthcare. It's been its fragmentation. And Peter Jr., I'm sure, is faced with some of these complaints that there's no continuity of care. It's all distributed amongst specialists who don't really know the other half. And when you have a primary care physician controlling this or guiding this or being the manager of this, there's going to be, I think, a major increase in the general happiness of the patient. I had the pleasure of being a delegate to the AMA at the time the Millis Report was commissioned, and it was commissioned, as you all know, by the AMA itself, the Council on Medical Education, which has probably been the most significant committee of the AMA over the years. Is the general practitioner's status declining, with the specialist getting the cream of hospital appointments, the best and easiest hours, the most pay, and the greatest status, it was no wonder, really, that their general practitioner was going into a steady decline on a national basis in the United States. With the creation of the board and of family practice, this was an incredible shot in the arm for the evolution and beginning to pull people back into the field of general practice, or now family practice. And the mission as a comprehensive doctor, a true primary physician with equal educational rank and status with the specialist, I think was really something incredibly important. And a reversal of the specialization trend began. Of course, there were other reasons for this, as Phil pointed out, because sometimes that's where the money came from. But with the evolution of the board and the two subsets of the board, a special competence in geriatric medicine and a special competence in family practice, in sports medicine, each requiring additional training in those fields, allowed further enhancement of the primary care physician. In the U.S. in 1900, there were 76 million people in the entire United States. And we had 119,000 MDs, almost all male, and there were 10,000 specialists at that time. In 1975, there were 482,000 male and 86,000 female physicians. So it's major, major change occurring for a total of 568,000 doctors. At this time, there were 37,000 male family practitioners and 7,000 female family practitioners, and general practitioners numbered 25,000. So they had the change had begun to occur. The family practitioner was beginning to ascend, and the general practitioner was beginning to disappear. By 1996, there were 580,000 male and 157,000 female physicians, serving a population of 265 million in the United States. So in less than a century, we'd gone up by 100 million people. We had, at this time, there were now 47,000 male family practitioners, 15,000 female practitioners, for a total of 62,000 family practitioners, really labeled as such. And there were family and general practitioners, the ones basically without the board training, had dropped to 16,000. It was a major turnaround, but it was still not enough. In Palo Alto, now at the Palo Clinic, we now have 180 doctors, and we have 33 family practitioners, up from three during my tenure there. We have 45 internists, and we have only three general surgeons, one vascular and one thoracic surgeon. So you can see the balance is really very, very different from the national balance. The Millis Commission felt that their ideal place for a family practitioner was in a group practice, and that he or she could utilize the specialized colleagues for their help in diagnosis and treatment and special procedures. And group practice would give the patient the advantages of continuing contact with the physician who knows him well and knows his medical history, combined with access to the wider array of skills and facilities. There also has been an increased status of the family practitioner. He or she now has boards. The pay has become somewhat comparable, at least in our institution. And they pass the exams. They need to recertify every 7 years, and they get 2 weeks off for education every year and all the time necessary to study for the new or the review boards that they have to take. They are staffing now. Family practitioners are now staffing the urgent care facilities. The female physicians are able to job share, which is a great plus for them. We have sometimes two share. We have about 10 female doctors job sharing at the present time. And they work in sports medicine and geriatrics. And they have an ever-increasing load of patients who really love them for the comprehensive care that they're able to give without the fractionated care they were getting at the hands of the specialists. It's really, I think, a major evolution from the lonely, isolated general practitioner, sleep-deprived, relatively poorly paid, to the new family practitioner who has significant empowerment with management positions and a marked increase in quality of life and lifestyle and good pay. And in the spirit and letter of the recommendations of Millis and those who have followed him, we now make provisions for additional time off. They have sabbaticals and vacations, things almost impossible for the individual and solo practicing general practitioner. There, of course, is still a tremendous shortage nationally, and people like Pete have done a great deal to help that. To alleviate that by establishing 17 residency programs in the Southern California area, and that's pretty significant, isn't it? 17, Pete, that you've made.
Not I.
Yeah, well, you evolved, yeah.
Well, I've watched.
Watched. Oh, yeah. But there's been a real move, though. At, as Bill Fox would know, that Stanford does not have any primary care, any family practitioner program at its own university hospital. And I think this still, I don't know if they have one at UC or not, Phil. They have a family practice.
We just moved it out and put the in vitro fertilization group in.
Yeah, well, that's where the money is. Well, we find the knowledge and vitality and energy and intelligence of the new family practitioners that we were able to recruit just fantastic. And they've been a wonderful addition to our institution now, and we're really delighted to see them. And we'd like to see the increasing turnaround. It's still pretty competitive in our recruiting for family practitioners. The last surgeon we got, we had 70 applicants for one job. And as you know, Stanford Anesthesia last year turned out 13 anesthesia residents, and 6 of them couldn't get a job. And 3 of them went to Kaiser as nurse anesthetists, even though they were MD anesthetists. So, you know, this great glut of specialists we have, we still keep cranking them out, but we're doing better on the others. Well, it's been a great pleasure addressing you all, and thank you for your attention.